There was, you know, one day in particular that I remember distinctly. I think it was early 2005. I was working at Harlem Hospital, and this colleague of mine, Dr. Olajide Williams, came to me and he said, "Jamie, you need to get rid of the pager today." I was on call for neurology at the time, and I said, I was all dressed up. I was ready to go. I was, you know, had my scrubs on. I said, "I can't get rid of the pager today. Why?" He goes, "No, you got to get rid of the pager. You know, hand it off, have somebody else cover me for a few hours." And it was one of those things like, when you're on call, like, it's your responsibility. You don't hand off these responsibilities. And he says, no, you got to do it. I'm just telling you, you got to come with me. I said, "What are we doing?" And he says, "We're going to go to a local elementary school and teach little kids about stroke using hip hop." And I said, "What?"
Dr. James Noble is a big-time neurologist at Columbia in New York City. He teaches there, he sees patients who have dementia, and he's on a team of these experts who focus on sports-related brain injuries. He's also on the board of an organization called Hip Hop Public Health with the human beatbox himself, Dougie Fresh. But back in the 90s, Jamie Noble used to come to Lucy's record shop. I hadn't seen or talked to Jamie in quite a few years when a post about the nonprofit he founded called Arts and Minds popped up in my LinkedIn feed. And I reached out to him about this podcast, and he said he'd be up for it. And then he started sending me emails. I mean, these emails had so much great info about his life and his work and his family, and of course the time that he spent at Lucy's. The irony is really thick here. He's trained to study memory and treat diseases of the brain, and he remembers a lot of stuff and a lot of detail. I remember the first time I met Jamie. I mean, not the exact date and time, but definitely the first conversation we had one night at Lucy's. He told me he was pre-med at Vanderbilt, and I thought, what the heck is he doing at a rock show on a school night? My idea of pre-med was that all you did was study and that you had no time for anything else, but Jamie wasn't like that. He had a ton of capacity for all the things he liked, and one of those things was music. When we talked recently, he told me that his love of music has never been pushed aside. Not by school, not by work, not by a marriage and 4 kids in 5 years, and not by a board gig that once landed him and a bunch of Nashville musicians on the South Lawn of the White House standing next to Michelle Obama. Music has been a constant thread in Jamie's life since he was a little kid.
My dad and my mom had a fairly small record collection. My dad grew up in, they both grew up in the same town, but they didn't actually become a couple until they went to college together, but they're from a small town in Southwest Michigan called St. Joseph. And my dad played in the high school marching band, so did my mom. My dad ended up playing in the Michigan marching band as well, played trombone and baritone, which is euphonium, or kind of like a valve instrument. And growing up, he told me stories that, you know, he went to see one of his favorite records, which he used to play all the time, is called Skin Deep. It's a track on Hi-Fi Ellington Uptown. I think it was a 1951 album, and it's got Louis Belson playing the double bass drum. And I remember, like, hearing that. There's, if you've never heard it, it's an incredible early drum statement, I guess. It's the first kind of touring double bass drum guy. So it was a very memorable drum solo. It was played all the time in my record player at home. But my dad went to go see him. He told me stories of seeing that band. It was in the Playboy Club in Chicago. I think it was like 1958. He drove down with his buddy to go see him. I think he said the Ramsey Lewis Trio was playing in the foyer as they walked in. I mean, can you imagine? 1958, 59, something like that. And then he used to drive up. There was a little place at, called Lake Pawpaw, and he went and saw Louis Armstrong up there. So my dad was the kind of person who back in the 50s would hop in a car and drive a few hours to go see a band because he wanted to.
Music was such a part of Jamie's life. At one point, he thought about becoming a music critic.
I just realized I didn't want to tell people that they stunk every day, which was kind of like, you know, what a lot of music critics do.
So I asked him, why medicine?
I wanted something also that was going to be practical, engaging, different. You get to talk to people. You know, I realized I was a very social person, and I enjoyed that. And it seemed like medicine kind of checked all those boxes. So it was largely my search of a career in medicine was just to say, okay, well, what else if not medicine? Almost to the point of like challenging myself to figure out if this was the right path.
Jamie lived in Nashville basically full time as an undergrad at Vanderbilt in the 90s. He worked concert crew for the national touring bands that came through town and played Memorial Gym or Langford Auditorium. And he had what he calls his defining musical experience at Vanderbilt's WRVU. He started as a DJ when he was a freshman and eventually became GM just a few short years later. Just like his dad, Jamie loved live music. And during his time in Nashville, he was a constant presence at Lucy's.
I remember going there my first time. It was that much of a kind of transformative experience. And I remember kind of the path of getting there. And I think part of it was in my fall of my freshman year at college. So I went to Vanderbilt University and I landed there knowing nobody. There were two other classmates of mine from high school that went, but I didn't know any, I didn't really hang out with them. And I remember being very bummed because I had Nine Inch Nails tickets in Atlanta that weekend that I landed there, and I couldn't go because I had to go to college, you know, and so it was like, you know, I was excited to see them. And then lo and behold, I walked into the mail room and there was a big poster for Nine Inch Nails playing at Memorial Gym. And so like the first weekend I landed in Nashville at Vanderbilt, all of a sudden there was music around us. And so I was very excited about that. I knew about the radio station. I had met some folks the summer before I started. And so I was actually already kind of making ways towards getting to the radio station, but I didn't know much about the local music scene. So it was kind of like, you know, the big bands traveling, the local music at Vanderbilt, but I didn't know much about the local scene. And I remember being at a Pavement concert at 328 Performance Hall in, I think we came up with the date. It was either September or October of 1994. I was 18 at the time. I was hanging out with Brian Bowling, who, you know, later became a clerk at Lucy's. He and I ended up playing in a band together. We were doing some things together at the radio station. And we were sitting there at the end of the Pavement show, just kind of hanging out. All the audience members were filing out. And there was Brian sitting there chatting with Jonathan Marks. And Jonathan was chatting with Bob Nastanovich. And I think Brian and I both had a healthy dose of envy that somebody that we kind of like were hanging out with actually knew Bob Nastanovich. It was kind of we were a bit starstruck, I think. Just, you know, I don't know how many people are starstruck over Bob Nastanovich, but there we were. So then Brian introduced me to Jonathan, and Jonathan said, and Brian said, yeah, there's a show coming up this weekend or next week. I think this band Lamb Chop's playing. You got to come down and check it out at Lucy's. And so there it was, like 2 weeks later, I was at Lucy's seeing a Lamb Chop show. And I was hooked. It was the coolest experience, live experience, just to have such a different sounding band and a complete, it was almost like a ready-made culture of, you know, musicians and music fans. And so, you know, some kids I was going to college with were all just, it was like this institution that was just, it was established and it was there. You know, I was in a band in high school and I played a bunch of bars and, you know, some of the bigger stages in the, you know, kind of club stages in Atlanta. And I'd never really seen something like that. It was very disjointed. But Nashville had a very different flavor about it. And I just loved it. It was a little record shop in the front and a stage in the back. And they were about equal size, both rooms. And everybody had a great time. It was amazing.
And what kept you coming back?
It just had this feel to it. You know, you'd walk in, you were there behind the counter. I don't think we got to know each other that well, but it was like there was this familiarity with it, a very kind of homey coziness to it. You had that leather couch in the front with dogs, you know, pestering you every time you know, where else do you walk in and there's a dog smell in your butt, you know, as you're trying to check out a record, you know, that kind of thing. It was, but you didn't mind it. It was just kind of fun, you know?
Memory is a really funny thing. Did you ever talk to a friend and they vividly remember something that you have no memory of at all? I mean, yeah, some people remember more stuff, but mostly people just remember different stuff. Jamie remembers a lot about the shows he saw at Lucy's. So when I asked him about a favorite band he saw or a record he bought, his answer was as specific as you'd expect it to be, but it was also really enlightening because I don't remember kicking him out at all.
As far as my, you know, records I bought, I remember picking through the 7-inch bin a lot just because it was, you know, you could get albums anywhere, but you could only get certain things at Lucy's, you know. 7 inches were one. I remember buying a double LP Guided by Voices live album there. I've never seen it since. The one with the blimp over Cleveland, I think. I know I bought that one there. The most memorable shows that I went to were not necessarily the ones that were packed out, but the ones that kind of presented new music or, you know, music that I was eager to hear and was not expecting to hear. It's kind of on word of mouth. I remember one show that really affected me was Bug Skull. This kind of instrumental band that played there, and their record I bought that night didn't sound anything like what they played, but they were a great band. I saw Low, Blonde Redhead when they were a quartet. That was the one time I actually had to leave during a show because my ears were hurting. It was so loud during the Blonde Redhead show. And then I saw Do-Rag twice, and we can talk about one of those shows if you want, but I remember when you kicked us all out under the curb. It was an amazing show nonetheless. We'll be right back.
Do-Rag were these two guys from Tucson. They played extreme lo-fi punky blues. Thermos Molling made his instruments out of stuff that he found out on the street, and Bob Log banged the shit out of his guitars. Their reputation was for whipping the mosh pit into a violent frenzy, so I'm sure I was on edge even before they started to play, because I always was when any band with that kind of history played a show. In the back of my mind, I was thinking, is anyone going to get hurt this time? If my memory is right, though, we only had one incident that was followed up by a trip to the emergency room. And I really need to find that girl. Let's get back to the Do-Rag show. I kicked you out. I don't think I kicked you specifically out, but I kicked
You kicked all of us out.
I have no memory of that. So you're going to have to refresh my memory.
We were like, somebody pissed off Mary Good. So I saw them twice there. And the first one was they played on the stage. They had the big oscilloscope and the giant bullhorn that they pilfered from, like, you know, Army Navy surplus. And he was singing through a vacuum tube and everything. And the second night, it was Chris Davis and the Frothy Shakes. It was like 2 years later. And something happened. And I think Do-Rag was drinking backstage. And they royally made you mad. And we heard like a scream from the back. And all of a sudden you came out to the front and you're like, everybody out. This is it. We're done. Get out, everybody now. Out we came. It was probably like 30 of us standing on the curb, and you like slammed the door, locked it, turned off the lights, and you just left. And we were just kind of going, what was that? And then the rumors started saying, well, they were drinking in the backstage or something. And you were like, you know, no alcohol, that can't be permitted. You were worried about staying afloat. So then they ended up doing a show on the curb. They had a couple of Pignose amps and a bunch of battery powered stuff. And there we were, like, watching Do-Rag on the curb right in front of Lucy. So none of us left. We just sat there and watched Do-Rag on the curb. That was funny you don't remember it, but man, we remembered it.
Lucy's had really strict rules, but for a very specific reason. I mean, we knew from past experience and the local scuttlebutt why other all-ages clubs were shut down. It's because bands and the kids who went there snuck in alcohol. As Do-Rag and a few other bands found out, we were not playing. The no alcohol rule was non-negotiable. Another rule that most people liked much better was that you didn't need to have a lot of experience to play Lucy's. We hosted really great bands and some really not so great bands and a bunch in between. Jamie and his friends Brian and Sherry formed a band called Lepus.
There was a bad science fiction movie on television one night called Night of the Lepus, I think it was, there were these giant rabbits that were like ravaging a town, you know, kind of some, it may not have even been Roger Corman. I think it was like a Roger Corman ripoff kind of thing. And Brian and I were watching it and he was like, yeah, we should call ourselves Lepus. Lepus was much more, again, I would say echoing our influences of the time. We listened to a lot of stuff off of Thrill Jockey and Touch and Go. I think anybody could have walked in there and said, oh, you're just trying to rip off Tortoise or something like that. And guilty as charged. But that was the music we listened to, and that was what we absorbed and I think played. We played two shows, but only one at Lucy's. We played another one and in the basement of my dorm, and I ended up not playing that night because I had a chemistry test, as I recall. And Brian and Sherry were quite upset with me, like, you know, dork, you know, that kind of thing. But I was there to, you know, get all A's. That was my thing. But yeah, no, we played that one night at Lucy's. I was so excited to play. I couldn't believe we were playing. I couldn't believe I was in a band playing in college. We'd rehearse out at Sherry's house in this kind of back room she had. I thought we sounded great. And the show sounded just awful that night, you know, but that's that. That was maybe I had false expectations, but I did not think we sounded very good. And my, you know, very polite friends in the audience complimented us, and it just seemed like false praise to me, but we sure had fun getting there and playing it. And I just, like I said, it's a fantastic memory for me getting to play a place like that, be part of that experience. At the time, I don't know if I thought it had any kind of historical gravity. I'm not to say it does, but just for my own personal history, it means a lot.
Do you remember the other bands that played there that night with you?
Yeah, so it was Brown Towel. So that was our friend Jack Sass. He was another DJ. I think he played kind of, you know, drums in the band off and on. And then Crop Circle Hoax, which were these brothers based out of Murfreesboro, kind of power pop guys. Or if they weren't brothers, they sure looked a lot alike. But we saw Crop Circle Hoax probably as many times as I saw Lamb Chop. They seemed like always the kind of go-to band that was either up for a show or up for opening, with a lot of fun fun songs. I bought their albums and 7-inches if they had there too.
Hey, out there, the sound is stupid. The stick is standard. The player's goofed up. But it's all okay. You know it's okay. Because anyway, you know I've been there.
After college and during medical school, he went to Emory in Atlanta. He kept up with the local music scenes wherever he went, including New York City, where he did his residency. In 1998, for some reason he can't explain, but thinks it was probably because he wanted to listen again to all of the shows he had seen at Lucy's and at 328 and at Exit Inn, he bought himself a handheld mini disc recorder for Christmas and began to record nearly every show he went to. Most of these are at the University of Georgia in the archives of Henry Owings of Chunklet. If it wasn't clear to you before, it should be right now. Music is more than a hobby to Jamie. It's a lifelong love affair. And after so many years of searching for his next favorite band or album or live show, one day the music found him.
I would say my thread of music and my love of music has been one of the most important attributes of led me to make certain decisions about my professional career. And there was, you know, one day in particular that I remember distinctly. It was early 2005. I was working at Harlem Hospital. And this colleague of mine, Dr. Olajide Williams, came to me and he said, Jamie, you need to get rid of the pager today. I was on call for neurology at the time. And I said, I was all dressed up. I was ready to go. I was, you know, had my scrubs on. I said, I can't get rid of the pager today. Why? He goes, no, you got to get rid of the pager. You know, hand it off, have somebody else cover me for a few hours. And it was one of those things like, when you're on call, like it's your responsibility. You don't hand off these responsibilities. And he says, no, you got to do it. I'm just telling you, you got to come with me. I said, what are we doing? And he says, we're going to go to a local elementary school and teach little kids about stroke using hip hop. And I said, what?
What's up, y'all, ladies and gentlemen? My name is Doug E. Fresh. And I'm here with the hip hop doc. Let's go. Let's go. Stroke, stroke. Stroke, stroke.
Come on.
Stroke, stroke.
Uh-huh.
He said, no, we're going to do this. I said, you're not serious. He goes, no, trust me, you got to do this. I said, all right, if this doesn't work out, you owe me a beer, okay? He goes, all right. So he and I got in a car. We went up to a local elementary school, and there was a group from the National Stroke Association that was there playing a song and cartoon that was actually first developed by, I think it was the Department of Health in Massachusetts. And it was a kind of a clever little song, but a bit juvenile. But that was the point, was that, you know, maybe you can teach little kids about stroke using music and cartooning. And the kids, they had this very engaging group of teachers there, and they were, you know, the kids would say, all right, what, you know, how do you recognize stroke? There's an acronym, FAST, face, arm, speech, and time. Time to do what? Call 911. And these kids were screaming 911. And we came out, my ears are ringing, like I'd been at a concert. And he said, what do you think? I said, have you studied this? You got to study this. This is amazing. He said, do you think so? I said, oh, yeah. This is amazing. So one thing led to another. We got a research, you know, approvals and IRBs and so forth. We got all the everything in order, and we started studying it formally within the next year. And that led to a whole fleet of programs, including NIH-supported programs, which collectively have taught over 100,000 kids using music and cartooning and comic books about different, you know, health initiatives, including stroke. I have one. It's called Old School Hip Hop. We have others that are focused on nutrition and exercise. We use legitimate artists. So our very first program, we worked very closely with Doug E. Fresh. You know, he's a local resident, was very engaged with the program, had personal stories that compelled him to work with us. We ended up getting connected with a guy named Jan Ellis James. He's a professor of filmography at NYU. He's also an Emmy Award winner at Sesame Street. He worked with a guy named Bill Davis, who just passed last year. Bill Davis did the opening credits to Reading Rainbow, which I'm sure you're familiar with. And so he did all of our cartooning for years. And so we had, between Doug and Jan and Bill, and we ended up later on working with Chuck D and DMC from Run DMC, EZAD from the Cold Crush Brothers, and Artie Green, who's done some producing work with Ja Rule and Ashanti.
When I say brain, you say attack. Brain, attack. Brain, attack. Come on. If he don't sound right, he may be doing the show. Sways when he walks, he's doing the show. Slur when he talks, he's doing the show. Call 911, cause it ain't.
I think because I knew music so well, like we kind of all spoke the same language, even though we came from very different backgrounds. And I realized the importance and the legitimacy of putting a good musical, you know, educational program together. If you did it right, it could be very meaningful. You know, the thing I've so enjoyed in working about this program is my main colleague, Dr. Williams, he didn't grow up in the States, so he wasn't familiar with Schoolhouse Rock. you know, I grew up listening to, you know, the ditties of Schoolhouse Rock, you know, Conjunction Junction and I'm Just a Bill and so forth. And you realize at some point, okay, well, is it more important for you to know what Ann Button or do or how to recognize a stroke or how to recognize, you know, other important health issues? And clearly, you know, the answer is trying to educate our multiple generations through kids is a easy and wonderful way to do it and gets kids excited. So it's been so rewarding, so fulfilling, and it's been a constant thread of the work that I do over the last 15 years.
I want to jump.
How high?
I want to jump.
So high.
I want to find.
The origins of the nonprofit organization Hip Hop Public Health came about because the Partnership for Healthy America, which is Michelle Obama's nonprofit organization, got wind of the work that we were doing. And they said, wouldn't it be great if you could put an album together for us? So with basically no budget and calling in a lot of favors, myself and a bunch of our friends basically tried to call any person with a musical connection we could think of and see if they'd be willing to donate a song. And some of the calls were more successful than others, but I ended up just kind of cold calling Paul Birch, and he ended up providing a song.
Touch your toes right to the ground.
The White House, I think since the like early 1900s, has had a, on the Monday after Easter, has had something called the White House Easter Egg Roll. And there are these basically these eggs, in, you know, the hard-boiled eggs that they give little kids wooden spoons and they roll the eggs down the back lawn. And usually they're, at least in modern times, they have five waves of people, about 4,000 or 5,000 each that come through. And the second wave, the president and the first lady come out and kind of mill around with the public. And so they, you know, we kind of developed this relationship and we ended up having a request to perform four of the last 5 years of the Obama administration. And we would bring, you know, one or two of our musicians. Usually it was Dougie Fresh performing. The 1 year, like I said, we had Dr. Oz with us. He was a big supporter of us some years ago. And of course, like Michelle and Dr. Oz were, I mean, they talked about her colonoscopy, I think, on his television show or something like that, you know. So it was just kind of a weird mix of everybody that came together. But we had, Doug was there, I think, just about every time. Artie Green was there with us, and others in our group came there a few times as well. But Paul was there just that one time. In the end, you look back and you're like, I can't believe we were there on the South Lawn. You know, the White House, especially the last presidency, you know, that kind of thing would never happen. You know?
You also have a nonprofit called Arts and Minds, and it's interesting to think about your work as a neurologist. Does art and art therapy help more than music and music therapy?
Yeah, I mean, as much as music music is such a strong thread in my life, the simple fact is that visual art is more ubiquitous than musical arts are, or at least they're more accessible to some people in certain contexts, right? My interest in this came from me attending programs in summer of 2008 at the Met and at the MoMA here in New York City. And at that time, they were just starting to organize some programs that were focused on providing art-based programs for dementia patients and caregivers. And I went to them with an interest in trying to understand how do people who have Alzheimer's disease express themselves through art. I was interested in just kind of the more mechanical aspects of it. You know, what does artwork look like in somebody who is having a chronic progressive brain injury? What does that look like? How does it manifest? Does it change? How could you study it? But when I was there, I came away with a very different and I think more meaningful question. And that was, how can we improve the lives of patients and caregivers? And maybe this is the way.
This podcast is certainly about Lucy specifically, but it's also about community in general, how and why they're formed, what makes them special, why they're necessary. It was clear by talking to Jamie that he inherently understands the importance of forming communities with his friends at work and at home.
How do you make your ideas fit in, or how do you make others understand your ideas? And I probably first had an experience with that when I was in band, like when I was in a band like Lepus or the one I had in high school, where you're working with either in my college band, it was two other people, in high school, it was three other people. These are your close friends. They're incredibly artistic. Everybody is strong-willed, strong ideas, and trying to understand how do other people's ideas get into the conversation and sustain your own as well. I think, and even now I think about any research team that I'm on, like, okay, who's my drummer? because you know, if they're having a bad day and they pull out the cymbal solo while you're trying to get your work done, it makes the rest of the day kind of hard. But you know, who's your bass player? Who's going to be your lead guitarist? Who's your singer? I think understanding all those personalities, I think about it in the course of my work, you know, when I'm putting together a team, and you want to make that band sound good. Well, when we started having kids, that definitely starts cutting down, and other priorities start catching up with you. But the musical thread that does start to come alive is that you get to share your joy of music with them. You know, it's a new cycle, right? So, you know, what are songs that you've listened to for many years that any kid would, you know, enjoy to listen to? Or what are some songs you can pick out on a guitar with a kid on your lap? You know, so I've got a lot of pictures of me with my kids when they're little, either both of us asleep, or, you know, me with like a Buck Owens guitar in my lap and my daughter sitting on my knee or something like that. You know, I treasure those moments.
Do you share music with your kids? Any specific artists?
I will try to share new music with them. My older daughter, I'm constantly pleasantly surprised how much she knows about music. I mean, she'll tell you about whatever new music she's listening to, but I was telling her a story about, I think I shared with you, the singer guitarist from Spider Virus. Jerry was my barber at the Heads Up barbershop on Elliston Place. And I remember him telling me a story about going to a house party where My Bloody Valentine was playing, and the house was shaking. And he said it was one of the most memorable things he'd seen. And I was mentioning this to my daughter, and my daughter was like, yeah, I don't really care for them. I've listened to Loveless and it's just not my thing. I was like, I didn't even tell her to go listen to Loveless, and it's not my jam necessarily, but the fact that she knew about it and had found it, job done, I suppose.
Yeah, so. Well done, Jamie. Well done.
You're doing that switching instruments thing. Feels that big vision. This next song, sure. You can... yeah, it's working. This next song you can hear on 91. It's called Laura Moore.
How are you?
Yeah, just call up and ask for it if you like it. If not,
good?
I will. I heard your voice for the first time. This prison shake to meet you. It rained that night. You played guitar. Big hair smells like pot. Not sure I like it.
Although you're not hearing it first, this is the first episode that I recorded. And the timing was really great because back then I had so many doubts, right? I mean, I didn't know if I should revisit the past. I didn't know if people would listen. But there was something about the way Jamie articulated what made Lucy's so special that made me believe there might be value here.
You asked me a minute ago, like, what made Lucy special? And it's one of those things, like many things in life, you don't realize how special it is until you're either past it or it's over unexpectedly, right? And it was one of these places where you felt completely safe and included. And it was like, you know, you belonged and you were supposed to be there. And I think that a lot of that just was about you. You know, you just felt like, okay, there's this matriarchal figure sitting at the cash register there, just letting people in, stamping hands and everything. And for all the, you know, there were plenty of kids, teenage kids that were there. There were kids like me. I mean, I was college age, but it just felt like a very welcoming environment. And I don't know that I've gotten that really at any other club that I've ever been to. I've gotten it at a few record stores, but it was only after I got to know the proprietor very, very well. But never at a club, you know. And I think that was the big difference for me. And it was one of those things, like I said, after in retrospect, you don't realize how special that was. And it, like I said, I landed there and it was so established. It was as though this is just the way things happen in Nashville. And it was great.
Even though Nashville and the world have changed so much over the last 30 years, one thing remains the same. It takes a community to support you, to lift you up, and to help comfort you during really difficult times. Thanks, Jamie. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any stories, pictures, or music you'd like to share from Lucy's, or have questions about things that we didn't cover or about people you'd like to hear on this podcast, send them along to @Lucy's Record Shop on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook, or email me directly at mary@lucysrecordshop.com. For more info about the stuff we touched on in this episode and links to full versions of the music featured, visit the episode notes or go to lucysrecordshop.com. Many, many thanks to Michael Eads for his time and the use of his studio, and to Lamb Chop for the intro music. This show is brought to you by Give 40 the Finger Productions and We Own This Town, a podcast network of original entertainment and documentary content. You can find more info at the official site at weownthistown.net or follow at We Own This Town on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Again, thanks for listening.